6, Reynes Lezama v. Garland. Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Stephen Spurgeon from Marfa, Texas. I'm the lawyer for Hilda Brennis, your petitioner. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. When I first received notice that this case was going to be heard for oral argument, I had intended to use the quotes of a prior immigration judge that heard this case of the acts of astonishing baselessness and depravity that the judge used to describe the pre-puberty rape of Hilda Brennis, her sister, her pregnant mother who lost the baby, and the battery acid that was poured on her siblings' feet and scalded them by the soldiers of Daniel Ortega, the dictator of Nicaragua, then and now. That changed this Monday when I received the case of Mendoza Flores from counsel in the Rule 28J letter. Because I had intended to speak to the court about not only these atrocities that took place, but the legal issue on the res judicata issue that the second immigration judge made to say that none of these acts that took place counted as past torture under the analysis of Section 1208, 16C of the federal regulations in Volume 8. I had intended to talk to the court about the board's treatment of the issue of the res judicata and the immigration judge's and board's complete and total failure to consider the gross, flagrant, and mass violations of human rights within Nicaragua as required under Section 1208.16C, including the expert report of Dr. Karen Campworth, which wasn't considered at all with respect to her evaluation and her opinion to the court on the dangers and the torture that my client faces if she's returned to Nicaragua. I call to your attention page 270, paragraph 33 of the administrative record with respect to Dr. Campworth's opinion, who is one of the premier authorities on Nicaragua in this country. But on Monday, my position changed because now we need to address jurisdiction and mootness.
Well, I just want to say you should address both. I mean, you've already addressed some of the merits, but the oral argument will address both. So you are not limited to the jurisdictional question in your argument.
I understand.
You can also address the merits and cover everything you want to cover because you've driven a long way to talk to us. We want to hear everything you have to say.
I have driven a long way, Judge. But the court's read the briefs. The court knows the facts. The court knows what this lady went through. The court knows how the immigration court cherry-picked the record to pick what they wanted to pick. The court's familiar with the things that took place with how when you get fondled by an officer of Daniel Nicaragua when she's returned to Nicaragua in 2011, they're fondled, she's threatened with rape, she has to pay money, she's strip searched, there's body cavity searches, she's put in detention, she's detained, and she's threatened with detention, and she's passed to pay her way out. The court's familiar with that. The immigration judge referred to it as the rogue agent analysis that this court has already frowned upon. And my reply brief addressed a case where our attorney general has said that the rogue agent doctrine doesn't apply and it agrees with this court. The court has that. I think the real emphasis has to be the jurisdiction mootness because none of this matters. None of what I've told you matters if this court doesn't have jurisdiction to fix this.
Okay, so how do you distinguish Mendoza Flores?
I'm not sure it's distinguished. My client is a convention against torture case. Mendoza Flores was a contention against torture case. Neither of them asked this court for a stay of removal. I don't think you can distinguish between the law the court used to make that decision. And with all due respect with Judge Haynes and Judge Odom who were on that panel, I believe due respect to this court, that perhaps it wasn't decided correctly, and here's why. I think we have to begin with Nikin versus Holder, which is the 2009 Supreme Court case that dealt with the issue of the stays of removal and what kind of proof was necessary in order to get a stay of removal from the court. And as this court knows, the Supreme Court focused and said the two most important issues was whether the applicant can make a strong showing that you're likely to succeed on the merits. But equally, if not more important, you have to show irreparable harm. And in the Nikin versus Holder case, I believe it's twice in Nikin versus Holder that Justice Roberts refers to this, but I believe at page 434 or 35 of 556 U.S., Judge Roberts speaks about how aliens who are removed may continue to pursue their petitions for review, and those who prevail can be afforded effective relief by facilitation of their return, along with the restoration of any immigration status they had upon removal. And Chief Justice Roberts cited to the government's brief at page 44 when he made that declaration in Nikin versus Holder. Why that's important, Your Honors, is it's this same theory and this same language that the Ninth Circuit used in the other case I cited in our response that we quickly got off to the court, and I regret that I didn't spend more time on this, and I regret that we didn't do more research.
Well, we're going to ask for more fulsome briefing because I agree that you didn't have much time and this is important, but we wanted something from you. So go ahead, finish what you're saying.
Well, and I think I'm able to find the important part, okay? And because the split we have with the Ninth Circuit that was decided in 2016 focused on the Nikin versus Holder language, and in particular, in Nikin versus Holder, the government made representations in their brief to the court that there's no irreparable harm to not stay somebody's deportation because we'll make a way for them to come back. And that was in the government's brief at page 44. Well, in the Ninth Circuit case, and I always have a hard time with this name, Del Cid Marroquin versus Lynch, in the Ninth Circuit case, around page 936 of the opinion, they go into a lot of detail about how they wanted the government and the parties to do further briefing on what would be the effect of them granting a petition for review in a convention against torture claim like ours where they didn't ask for a stay.
Do you not have an argument on the suffering collateral legal consequences from the challenge decision issue?
Well, the suffering legal consequences, Your Honor, is that if the court grants the petition, then she's got a way to return to the United States, and the United States government will help facilitate that.
How is that true? If we agreed with every single thing you filed in your briefs in this court, every word of it, if we grant the petition exactly the way you want it, she's still subject to the removal order because you never challenged that. It just like in Mendoza Flores. So Nikin obviously involves a removal order. In cases where there is a challenge to the removal order, I get it. I understand what you're saying. But if you'd never challenged the removal order, there's nothing we can do. Our hands are totally tied.
I understand the court's position and the argument, Your Honor, but this is the difference. And I quote from the language that the parties briefed on and the Ninth Circuit spoke of in the Del Cid Marroquin case, where they solicited a second round. And the court's reviewed the case. The court knows what the Ninth Circuit asked the parties to do. And the government states that the government stated that if the BIA, if the circuit court should reverse the BIA, and the BIA should either reverse it or send it to the immigration judge who finds in light that convention against torture should be granted, they would facilitate the person's return. And the Ninth Circuit spoke to specifically, in sum, While granting Dale Sid's American's petition will not guarantee his return to the United States, it will at least increase his chances of being allowed to do so.
Well, and I appreciate that point. The question I think that I was asking, so in Mendoza Flores, it says there's not a mooting if the petitioner would suffer collateral legal consequences from the challenge decision, i.e. the decision that we're addressing right here today. Is there any such thing here? In other words, is there a collateral legal consequence to your client if the BIA decision remained in place?
Well, the collateral legal consequence, Your Honor, is being subjected to torture in Nicaragua, which could be prevented by this court by remanding the case to the BIA to rule correctly on the law. By stripping cat claimants' rights to ask a federal court of appeals to fix great injustices. I mean, obviously, my client was convicted of an aggravated felony drug trafficking crime and lost her lawful permanent resident status as a result when was returned to Nicaragua. After the events that took place, she returned to the United States, and she was detained while she fought her immigration case at the trial level and at the Board of Immigration Appeals, and then was removed. So, I mean, I can't fix that removal order, and there's no way to challenge the removal order. I mean, she was lawfully convicted, and the law is very clear that if you're convicted of an aggravated felony drug trafficking crime, you're subject to removal from the United States, and you lose all the other ways you have to fix your papers, save for the Convention Against Torture.
That's not quite right, right? Because you could have filed a petition for a stay. I mean, we've talked about Nikin this morning. Well, sets forth the four factors, and we see them every day. And it could have been done before she was removed in March of 2020.
I'm not going to make excuses on the difficulty it is to get this done on a short period of time with the clock ticking and not having all the access to some of the records we need. But the Supreme Court found that Nikin didn't grant this. Didn't okay that particular stay, okay? Because there wasn't irreparable harm, because the government promises we'll bring them back. So I'm not sure why I'm asking this court to grant a stay.
I would have been able to argue irreparable harm if you can't be brought back because of this whole Mendoza notion, or the notion that without a collateral legal consequence, you can't come back. So, I mean, I don't know. It's a little surprising to me to argue that because you don't think you'll win, you don't file a motion for stay. If that were true of everyone, we'd get very few of them.
I thought the Supreme Court had spoken. There's no irreparable harm because the government promises to bring them back.
But
all my client has to do is keep
bring back aggravated felony conviction people. These promises to bring back. I mean, we have a ton of cases where the person was not removed because of some criminal event. They were removed because they were not authorized to come into the country. They came into the country. They didn't prove their asylum claim or sufficiently. They didn't win, let's put it that way, and they were sent home. That's what typically those cases are. They're not typically these cases. So I don't know that the Supreme Court was necessarily addressing every single case under the sun when it was addressing the government saying we'll bring them back. Because, as I said, in the most cases are not involving these kind of criminally convicted, so on and so forth, people that are claiming CAT. They're typically people who came in here either lawfully and then overstayed it, or did not have authorization, they were unauthorized, but claimed asylum.
Well, that's accurate. But under IRA, Congress has declared that you have authority to consider petitions of review even after someone is removed from the country. And that's what we have here. Congress didn't carve out an exception for people with aggravated felonies. Congress didn't carve out an exception to say, well, you know, we think it's moot because you didn't ask for relief for a stay of removal. Under IRA, the court has authority to consider petitions for review after somebody's been removed from the United States. And that's...
Pardon? Let me ask you this. Was the petitioner in our case, Mendoza Flores subject to the same contingent collateral consequence as your client?
I would say so, Your Honor.
And you know, we have to follow our authorities.
Pardon me, sir?
We have to follow our published decision of this court.
That's why I said I can't distinguish that. I can't, and so Judge Davis, I'm talking to you. I think we've already got a decision here on the other part. Let me address this with you, Your Honor. Congress didn't delineate that. They didn't carve out an exception under IRA to prohibit this court from considering this case or the one in Mendoza Flores. And there's a split in the circuits on it, and I haven't had a chance to check all the other circuits to tell you where they are.
Okay, you're
my time's up.
You save time for rebuttal, so you can have a seat. I'll go ahead and take.
Well, Judge, I may waive rebuttal.
We need to hear the other side's argument.
All right.
I think you'll want to stay to hear the.
Well, I want to hear it, but I'm not sure it's going
to. You want to get back in your car, but let's go ahead and hear the other side's argument.
Let me get this out of your
way. A moment to put your materials back. For the government.
May it please the court, Mari Luchter for the respondent. The court can resolve this petition in one of two ways. The court can dismiss the petition in accordance to Mendoza Flores that appears directly on point. Or the court can assume jurisdiction and deny this petition for review on the merits because the agency properly concluded that petition failed to meet her burden to be eligible for CAT deferral.
All right, now I want to understand, frankly, I wasn't aware that she had been removed until you all wrote your letter, but she was removed a year and a half ago. Why did y'all wait till this week when we were already here in oral arguments, not really able to put it off, to let us know that?
I was assigned to this case after the briefing was already completed, and when I started to prepare for the argument, I realized that Mendoza Flores was just directly on point, and I discovered it shortly before the argument when I started my preparation. So I did not realize that Mendoza Flores was directly on point until I started to prepare for the argument, and hence, I apologize, it's really late notice, I realized that.
Yeah, I do think we want to have more fulsome briefing on it. I don't think it was fair to your opponent. That, you know, he's packing his bags in the car and having to run around trying to do this research on something that's very significant. So I would ask that, today is the 5th. I would ask that by August 12th you file the appropriate motion on the jurisdictional point with full briefing, and then your opponent will have the opportunity to respond under the time rules of on motions.
I'd like to have an explanation in the brief for the delay, too.
Explanation for the delay?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that you didn't know and whatever, but it would seem like y'all would have known she was deported, and that would have been a question of something to raise somewhere in the briefing, and then we would have at least.
Right, Mendoza Flores was decided after the briefing was already completed in this case, so. I believe it was in December 2020, and the briefing was completed here in, I believe, July.
Yeah, but, I mean, the fact that she'd been deported,
right,
to me,
right,
is, even if that doesn't remove our jurisdiction, it is sort of interest, given her claim that as soon as she walked in the door, she would be harmed, you know? So I'm just surprised that wasn't even raised, okay? Then, as you say, Mendoza Flores came out last year. We get 28 J's the day after things get filed, you know? So I just find this all a little bit confusing, but the answer is, okay, we can't change the past, but we still have to address jurisdiction, whether we like the way it came to us or not. So as I said, by August 12th, y'all need to file a fulsome motion with fulsome briefing and explain why you didn't let us know all about this sooner. And then your opponent will have the time under the rules to respond, also more fulsomely, and we'll go from there. But in the meantime, you can go ahead and address both the jurisdiction and the merits in your oral argument.
Right, and the government really—
those two on the jurisdiction, cover any statutory or regulatory authority for preventing the reentry of a someone convicted of a violent felony. Is there statutory or regulatory authority for that? Put that in your brief.
What would happen if she flew back or drove back, came back?
If she came to back to the United States?
Yeah. Could she claim the cat then again?
She did in this instance, so I assume that that would be the case here again, and that's where the document—
I'm not suggesting she should come back, I'm just asking.
Correct. As the past indicates, and this is why the doctrine of res judicata was an issue that the immigration judge decided. And again, this is one of the reasons the court knows that even assuming the court can assume jurisdiction and decide the merits, realizing that it's the last minute at 28J letter and so forth, if the court so chooses to do.
Can we? I mean, I thought jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, I thought is something that can't be waived. A lot of stuff can be waived. And if it could be waived, man, you've waived it. But how could this be waived?
The court can perhaps reach the merits, assuming jurisdiction in this case, considering that there is already full briefing on the merits, and deny the petition based on the agency's reasons that the petitioner failed to meet her burden for cat deferral. If the court wants, I can go into the merits of—
Yeah, no, I definitely think you should. I mean, well, why? I mean, here's the problem that I have with the res judicata argument. I understand that she can't challenge that original decision, but doesn't the history of her life give some understanding to what happened after that? So even if you say the one rape or the issues that occurred before then weren't enough, they're not irrelevant to the fact that she's again mistreated when she goes back, right?
Correct. The immigration judge considered the past events for context. He ultimately concluded that he is not able to relitigate the issue of what happened to her in the past in 1984, which was exactly the issue that she raised and litigated in a prior removal hearing before in California. In fact, in the prior removal hearing, what happened to her, the harm she suffered, the horrible harm that she suffered, the question was whether that harm supports a finding of clear probability of future torture. And the agency in that case ultimately decided that although what she suffered was horrific, it happened over 20 years ago, and there was no other evidence otherwise to indicate that she would be singled out for harm.
Yeah, but she shows up at the airport and she's getting grabbed and, you know, mistreated at the airport right when we send her back. Why isn't that some evidence that she was right when she said, I'm abused by these people?
The immigration judge did consider that in context, ultimately not reaching the ultimate question of whether the 1984 events supported the finding of future torture. And in any event, as the board also indicated, even notwithstanding the res judicata issue, what happened to her, although horrific, it happened over 20 years ago, and did not alone support the finding of, did not support the finding of clear probability of future torture in a present-day Nicaragua. So even if, as the board noted, even if the doctrine of res judicata didn't apply here, similarly, these events that happened over 20 years ago, now over 30 years ago, did not support the finding of clear probability of future torture based on these events in present-day Nicaragua. And moving on to
that. Let me ask you one other thing about that. Why wouldn't what happened to her 20 years ago or 30 years ago be a consideration in how credible she thought the threat was that she would be jailed and raped when she reentered the country? I mean, wouldn't that tell her something about how credible that threat was?
the immigration judge in a prior hearing determined that the events did not support a clear probability of torture. The immigration judge in this case considered these events in context, although relying on res judicata, not ultimately deciding the issue whether these events supported a finding of clear probability of future torture, but the immigration judge did take, did consider this in context, and ultimately, even looking at all the evidence here, although what happened to her was horrific over 30 years ago now, it happened a really long time ago, and the events that happened at the airport, as the immigration judge noted, although they were distasteful and frightening, they did not meet the extreme level of torture. And further looked at...
It would be much closer to torture, though, if it was a credible threat, wouldn't it? In other words, if she had every reason to believe that it was a credible threat, I mean, I think we've got a case saying that can amount to torture.
The immigration judge in this case considered the record evidence, considered what happened to her, determined that although it was distasteful and frightening, it did not raise to the extreme level of torture. The immigration judge looked at the fact that she was threatened twice upon detention at the border, but she was released when she paid the extortion request or extortion money, and that the immigration judge also pointed out that the commanding officer during the first incident actually indicated to her not to tell anyone about the incident, indicating that he believed he could not act as he did with impunity. The immigration judge also evaluated the expert witness testimony and ultimately concluded that on balance, under the totality of circumstances, petition did not meet her burden, that it is more likely than not that...
What I saw was that he didn't consider the expert's report because the brother Chris's testimony undermined it. And Chris, as I understand it, had the same kind of threat made and then been living in hiding. So how did Chris's statement undermine the expert's testimony?
The immigration judge, as the board noted, looked at the record evidence.
I mean, I know what the immigration
judge said. Right. The immigration judge did look at the brother's declaration, and the immigration judge noted that the brother did not indicate that he was in hiding after the events. The brother noted that he was extorted because he was coming, in essence, he had connections to the United States, and these officers believed that he had money, and as a result, he was extorted. The brother did not indicate that he was in hiding. Indeed, as the immigration judge pointed out in his decision, the brother also noted that he went to the authorities, it seems recently, based on the declaration, and it was written in 2018.
Wasn't there some other evidence?
And was able to get the police report. Sorry.
Was there other evidence that he had been living in hiding since then?
Petitioner noted in her declaration that the brother was in hiding.
And he found her testimony credible, didn't he?
Yes, she was not found incredible.
All right, any other arguments?
Unless the court has any further questions for me, I'll briefly conclude. In conclusion, the court can either dismiss the petition or deny it on the merits. And as to the merits, the agency here reasonably concluded that petitioner failed to meet her burden of proof to be eligible for CAT deferral. Substantial evidence supports that agency's determination. And even if there were possibility of drawing two inconsistent conclusions from the evidence, that on its own is not sufficient to compel only a contrary conclusion. So, for these reasons, and for the reasons stated in respondent's brief, the court should deny this petition for review.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I misspoke. Maybe a few minutes in rebuttal.
I figured that.
Before you get started, can I ask you a question? Did you confer with your client before you filed your opening brief?
No.
You did not?
No.
So, when did you become aware that she'd been removed from the United States?
When she called and, well, I guess when she called and said, shortly after the board decision. I can't give you an exact date, Your Honor. I bet we have it in a record somewhere at my office. I don't recall that date.
But it would be, so she was removed in March of 2020, sorry. And you filed your opening brief on April 13th.
Yes.
So
we would have spoken, but when we speak, it's basically we have the record, if we had the administrative record at that time, we would talk about what the process is.
But did you know that she was not in the United States and had been removed by the United States government?
Yes, I knew when she got, they tell us when they're leaving.
So you knew before you filed the
brief? Her family, your question is, why didn't I put it in the brief?
Yeah, you.
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know why. I didn't anticipate this jurisdictional argument. I didn't. Perhaps I should have put that in my brief and alerted everybody to that fact.
But one side at least knew before the briefs were filed that she wasn't here, and it sounds like it was the
petition. Well, but Your Honor,
the government knew too.
That would be my point. Of course, the government knew.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if the oil lawyer knew or not. I mean,
the government deported her.
Right. I mean, the Department of Homeland Security deported her, and the question is, why does the Justice Department not know that? It sounds like we're going to have briefing on that. Maybe we can also have briefing on why
Petitioner
didn't put
it. Yes, Your Honor. In the briefing. Briefly, Judge Davis, you're correct. There's no statute of limitations on rape and torture. Simply because it happened a long time ago may go to the weight of the testimony, but it's not something that's kept out by res judicata, particularly when the prior courts in California that heard the case didn't deny the Convention Against Torture claim because there wasn't rape and torture. They denied it because the immigration judge said that he didn't think there was a risk that she'd be harmed in Nicaragua. Nobody in Nicaragua was looking for her, and Nicaragua did not have mass violations of human rights. That's all in his opinion.
Why did the immigration judge deny it in 2010 in this case?
In our case? Res judicata?
No. The first time. Why did they
get it? Oh, in the first case? Denied it because the immigration judge said that there wasn't a risk of that they weren't looking for her. Now, this is way before. Yeah, they weren't.
It's not true. Let's read the record together.
Okay. Well,
page 238 of the record on appeal. The reason it was denied is that acts of astonishing baselessness and depravity were not sanctioned by high-ranking officials in the Army, nor that political officials ordered, knew about, or condoned the abuse. That's a verbatim quote from the record.
Your Honor, that is a verbatim quote, and that is also contra to this court's opinions when it comes to rogue agents and the whole rogue agents analysis that has now been discredited by all the other courts. But if you look at page 239 of the judge's opinion, mm-hmm. and 239 of the record evidence, the judge says she loses because the Sandinista government isn't looking for her. And then she talks about how they talk again about the rogue soldiers, okay? And they also talk about how she wouldn't be harmed because the country reports in the record do not show mass human rights violations. And that's absolutely opposite of what the situation was when she lost in the El Paso Immigration Court with the mass human rights violations that the immigration judge in El Paso didn't even reference in his opinion. And the Board of Immigration didn't reference it in theirs either.
Counsel, I appreciate the passion of the argument, and everyone everyone agrees that the facts are horrific. But it's really important that we're honest about what the record says. And what the record specifically says is there is no indication that the men who perpetuated the assaults are still alive, active in the Army, that the current regime has any interest in the respondent or anyone in the family, particularly as the father is deceased, because this wasn't attributable to the government. That's a totally different legal error that I haven't heard you mention today.
Well,
you have to connect the horrible things that everyone agrees happened to the government.
We will, I've got some authority, we'll aside from that, on the United Nations, and I think there's a persuasive authority that came out of the United Kingdom on this here recently. We'll cite to also, I didn't get a chance to put it in our brief. But the rogue agent analysis, this court has discredited. And in addition, very, very briefly, it is very important for the court, Judge Odom, it's important to understand that my client is the niece of the Cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church in Nicaragua. And that changes the picture, too, on her importance to Daniel Ortega and his government and his wife, the vice president, have declared war on the Catholic Church. And that's also a circumstance that wasn't addressed by anybody in this case. That's Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, both sides. We have your arguments. The case is under submission, although, as I said, I am ordering the motion to be filed, and then you will file the response within the time allotted in the rules. But with that understanding, you all are excused, and our next argument is by video, so we will leave the courtroom, and that is the last of our live oral arguments for this sitting, and we appreciate the work of Ms. Engelhardt, and we appreciate y'all's arguments, and thank you.